From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, why many environmentalists are sounding the alarm over a proposed golf course in Kohler.
All the different grasses and plants that you would find in the state natural area, which is just a few feet that way. This area here, of course, would have to be bulldozed and flattened.
Later, how your body is hardwired to want or need certain foods.
We have this blueprint that our ancestors worked very hard to ensure the survival rate is high for us. And because of that, we are pre-programmed for certain frameworks.
We'll talk with Minnesota writer Kelly Barnhill about her new collection of short stories.
And our Fit for You segment takes a strenuous look at core strength. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The Kohler Corporation is inching closer to fashioning what it says will be a world-class golf course in Sheboygan County along the shore of Lake Michigan. Kohler's 200-plus acre parcel butts up against Kohler-André State Park's northern border and shares rare wetlands and dunes ecosystems.
Today, Wisconsin's Natural Resources Board will consider a small piece of the plan that actually includes the state park. The Wisconsin DNR wants to offer up a bit of parkland to Kohler to ease access to its new golf course and to house its maintenance buildings.
WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz visited the site and fills us in on some of the facts and fury the board will likely encounter during deliberations today.
The sun was bright and the air crisp as Jim Buchholz oriented me to where we stood within Kohler-André State Park.
We're looking this way. Here's the office in back of us here. And that's the entrance there. Goes over the bridge.
But Buchholz needs no map. He was park superintendent here for 27 years. The DNR wants to grant the Kohler Company an easement to allow golfers to share the main entrance with park users.
So they would build this roundabout here, and they're going to try to divide the traffic here.
Buchholz isn't worried about traffic patterns. He's thinking about what the new roundabout would cover, sand dunes that have survived generations.
Deposited by Algonquin, the glacial lake that was here. So it's open sand dune areas. It's got wetlands in it. It's got all the different grasses and plants that you would find in the state natural area, which is just a few feet that way. This area here, of course, would have to be bulldozed and flattened. And then the main road to the golf course would go right through the sand dune areas straight down this way.
The DNR plan also gives Kohler nearly 5 acres on which the company would build several maintenance buildings. Buchholz walks north and then bears west, crossing rolling terrain studded with dollops of snow and ice. In other spots, sand breaks through thick masses of grasses.
So actually, we would be within sight of the maintenance facility now. And from this location, you can see all the dune areas and the large trees here. Some of them are quite old as we get into the older areas. So we're kind of beyond the dune areas now into what we call the wooded dune areas, which makes up a big part of the park as well.
The DNR's proposal to the Natural Resources Board states this 4.59 acres of land is, quote, not being used for any park functions or services and is no longer needed for the state's use for conservation purposes. That statement leaves Buchholz baffled.
It's true, there's no trails through here. There's no restrooms here. There's no parking areas here or buildings, but that was done intentionally.
The retired superintendent says the rule of thumb is to develop less than 8% of a state park.
The rest is left for conservation purposes. That's exactly what we do for wildlife and for people to enjoy the natural area without having buildings here and so on.
Buchholz is not impressed with the parcel the Kohler Company would give the state in return.
It's a bulldozed area, flat, few trees. It's attached to the park on two areas, but it's surrounded by swamps, so there's no way you can walk from the state park to that area.
Doug Hagg with the DNR's Internal Services Division says the Kohler offer has value and points to buildings on the property.
Possibly providing employee housing, certainly some storage and administrative facilities, maintenance facilities that we can use to help provide some of the support facilities for the park out there.
And Hagg adds, it's not only important for the DNR to steward state parkland, but also work with landowners to make sure they have access to to their property.
Over the last 5 years, we've done about 50 land exchanges across department properties. And in terms of providing access across state land, we frequently have properties that either have very poor or no access, private inholdings. And we try to work with our neighbors. Our general belief is that people should have good, legal, permanent ingress and egress to their properties, farms, businesses, and homes.
Dirk Willis with Kohler says his company spent 3 years analyzing how to create as little environmental disruption as possible while bringing its new golf course to life.
This proposal has the least of those impacts. And if you look at that land per the DNR and the state, they deem it no longer necessary for any conservation purposes. So realistically, this potential proposal has the least impact.
Some people wonder if Wisconsin is setting a dangerous precedent by offering up even a small parcel of state parkland for development.
Lake Effect's Susan Benz brought us that feature about the golf course the Kohler Company plans to build in Sheboygan County just off Lake Michigan.
The Natural Resources Board was scheduled to take up the issue at its Wednesday meeting in Madison. There is a link to the proceedings from WUWM.com. And when you visit WUWM.com, don't forget to take part in our winter member drive, your chance to voice your support for Lake Effect and all the other programs that you hear each and every day on WUWM. You can also do that by calling 414-227-3210. And we have a special deal for you today as
well. We certainly do. If you donate $120 or more or $10 or more a month, you will automatically receive a WUWM tote bag. This is a very nice tote bag. I don't know about you, but I'm always bringing my lunch, and I always want to have a nice bag. And this is a great way to show off your support of the station and of the programming that you depend on here on Milwaukee's NPR.
You know, it's funny because we were talking about this. The tote bag seems like such a retro pledge premium or a membership premium or whatever the right term is for it. You know, years ago, they were really associated with public radio. They kind of disappeared for a while. But you know what? The need for tote bags has never gone away.
We still have to haul stuff. And this is a really, really great way to do it. That is $120 or more, or that is $10 a month or more. Today only, you'll automatically receive that WUWM tote bag. The number is 414-227-3210. You can also make your contribution at WUWM.com.
A short break now, and then we'll talk about listening for the cues your body gives about the foods it really needs. Intuitive eating when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Last fall, we learned about a Milwaukee startup called Genopalette, which is using DNA analysis to advise people on foods to eat and foods to avoid. During that interview, nutritional data analyst Laura Danner mentioned one of the revelations that had emerged from the first few dozen genetic analyses the company had done.
One thing that I think a lot of people have had a positive experience with has been something called intuitive eating, which is really listening to our body signals and really trying to figure out what we're hungry for, as opposed to just following whatever patterns are prevalent in the American diet today.
The principles surrounding intuitive eating have actually been the subject of scientific study for some time. Sherry Zhang is the founder and CEO of Genopalette and is also a longtime genetics and nutrition researcher, and so we invited her back into the studio in January to examine intuitive eating more closely. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me back, Mitch.
So can you give us kind of a working definition of intuitive eating?
Sure. Intuitive eating is a very interesting concept. It has been applied in the last years. So intuitive eating is a way of eating that encourages people to apply a set of simple principles to help someone to navigate and find a healthier relationship with food. So it involves in listening and paying attention to your body's cues for hunger and satiety, and also at the same time be very mindful about, you know, food can be easily used or abused as a emotional response.
So this isn't just about types of food. This is about just the entire nature of our eating.
Exactly. Yeah, there is, you know, obviously we pre-programmed, you know, we have this blueprint that our ancestors worked very hard to ensure the survival rate is high for us. And because of that, we are pre-programmed for certain, you know, frameworks of have more higher capacity to digest different kinds of fats. Or in my case, I'm from Asia originally. I have tons of a capacity to digest carbs. I can notice that difference when I'm comparing with my Caucasian friends.
So let me take a step back. This seems like, to hear how you describe it, the way historically we ate for centuries, the idea that we ate when we were hungry and we stopped eating when we were full and we ate the things that our body was calling for.
Exactly. So now we have so many distractions in our modern life. You know, we have this agenda of, you know, we have to get on to the next thing. And then we have all this bombardment from the advertising, the food industry, that this is a good diet, this is the next big thing, you have to try this and that. So all this distraction make this harder and harder for us to really listen to the cues in our bodies in a peaceful way. I think we should really do some due diligence and to reestablish that relationship with our body and the body to our food.
Are there things in, you know, for lack of a better term, the Western diet or the kinds of foods that so many of us eat in this country and in society, are there things in those foods that are actually keeping us from more clearly hearing what our bodies are asking for?
Yeah, for example, high sugar, right, or processed carbohydrates, refined carbohydrates, and fats too. So all these signals that originally we are very sensitive to, right? A little bit the nutrients, a little bit nutrition and food and energy source is so precious in our ancestors' life because, you know, they hunt down, they chase their dinner and they finally got it. And then sometimes when they have that ripe fruits, that's why we got this very sensitive feedback loop to the rewarding to when we get something sweet. You know, I was very excited and it would make us satisfied. But now we have this unlimited supplies of those sweeteners and fats and so on. Our brain is really confused and they're not programmed to deal with so much signals of these satiety and rewards. And at the end of that, it became desensitized. So, you know, it's harder for us to really find that intuition that's really, is more agreeable to the wellness that was pre-programmed.
Well, and so how do we turn, if not turn the clock back, how do we start to go back to the way things were? I mean, what are the kinds of things that we can do to break out of that cycle and actually hear the cues and read them?
Yeah. First thing, just eat when you are hungry. Really listen to that. And, you know, maybe don't think about the dieting at all for a few days. You know, think about what really interests your palate. What do you like? Do you like spicy food? Do you like sweet? What kind of sweet do you like? And maybe next time you want something sweet, go for honey instead of artificial sweetener. Don't put those artificial things and bags of powders into your coffee anymore. You know, take a black coffee. It is. It's so wonderful as it is. And I enjoy simple ingredients nowadays. And it gives me such a pleasure that I can appreciate so much more. And then you can be creative and, you know, mix things up a little bit. But again, I think naturally simple ingredients that give you pleasure is the food that you want to eat.
Once you've been able to kind of take some of these distractions away and are going for the things that you have a taste for, whether they're spicy or salty or sweet or anything else, As a molecular biologist, how do we know that this is really what our body wants and these aren't false cues?
Right. Yeah. Great question. We don't necessarily know all the time, but our gut feelings on this topic is pretty good. You know, again, take all these drugged effect from, you know, all those high sugar processed food. If you can really quiet down your body for a day or two, you'll be able to have very good intuition for what's really is agreeable to your body program, and take advantage of the technologies we are offering. You know, 100 years ago, we would never have a way to sequence your DNA and to track down your ancestry. Now we can. You know, all these Ancestry.com, 23andMe, Genome Palette, all these great platforms, they can help you get the initial insights of your DNA sequence for your nutrition, molecular pathways that make you at risk or at advantage and for certain food.
Your suggestion a few moments ago that we ought to eat when we are hungry is, on one level, obviously sort of very intuitive, but I know there has been a lot studied and written about whether we even realize that we're hungry sometimes. I mean, there are people who might eat because they're bored or might eat because they're stressed, or they might eat for other reasons. What does it take to be able to figure out whether you're eating because you're hungry or eating for other reasons?
Yeah, great, great point. So part of the intuitive eating involves the awareness of food can be applied as an emotional response to anger, to sadness, anxiety, stresses from your work or relationship, all that can make you wanting to use the food to make it a more enjoyable situation than it is. But what happens, as we all know, I have done that. I hope you haven't, but I'm assuming you have done that.
I'm sure I have, yes.
Once or twice in your life. When we do that, the problems don't go away, obviously, because we eat. We didn't deal with the problem. And then at the end of it, now that the problem is still there and we feel more guilty, you know, because we gain pounds.
Right. We still have the problems, and we have the additional problem of having eaten the wrong thing or too much of something.
Right. And on top of that, we actually once again abuse our body one more time, and it makes such a vicious cycle, you know, just make it into a bad habit. And many people are stress eaters, as we sometimes describe them are. And I think for people, including myself momentarily, when we have the wanting to use food as a tool to solve those emotional problems, you know, just sit back and say, this is a wrong way of using food that way. Food is for our nutrition, for your health, for pleasure. And if you can go back to that mentality, I think you're one step closer.
There's a certain amount of mindfulness that has to go into that, being able to interrupt the thought where I'm just going to reach for that bag of M&Ms in my drawer.
Right. Yeah. You need to be, you know, mindful, intelligent about it. And I think it's a habit can be reformed. You know, it's rewarding because your body going to like you and thank you afterwards. And this is how I quit soda many years ago. I love soda. I love Coke. And you know, and then I read about all these, other than sugar, that we all know, soda is bad for your bone health too, so and skin for a female. So I just one day I said, you know, I'm gonna try to stay away from it. And in the beginning, it was very hard, and I still crave for that from time to time. But my body likes it, and it forms this almost like a different cues when next time I drink soda, it actually doesn't like it. It has a different signals in my body. It's very interesting.
How long did it take you to realize that your body no longer liked it?
Months for me, for soda, and probably never for ice cream. I recently, from my report, my company did. I'm lactose intolerant, and before I was like a guessing game. I said, you know, maybe I have the other part of the gene can do it. But and then it, you know, I got the result back. I was like, you know what? For the first time, I'm gonna totally be, you know, honor my body in a respectful way. So I took that away. But you know, I miss ice cream, regular ice cream. All the time.
Well, and I think that, but I guess the point that I was getting at is there are some things that people might notice right away, but there are other things that are really going to take time to recognize when it comes to the benefits of intuitive eating.
Yeah, correct. It's a process, just as everything else. We have 28,000 genes in our body, and the combinations of that is almost, you know, unlimited. Combinations of enzymes, pathways, networks, organs, you know, tissue specificity and all that. I don't want to bore you with that, but this is my world. So I know how complex that system can be. Half of these genes have something to do with digesting our food because that's guarantee our survival in the history. So just be aware of this. To me, it's not a, you may think it's, oh, it's too much. You know, how could I deal with it? But to me, it's a beautiful, wonderful thing. You know, life is such a course, and, you know, don't you be bored if you know that the answer right away? Don't you want to explore a little bit with your food, your nutrition, your relationship, your body a little bit more?
So how does science from here study, you know, what are the next frontiers in understanding intuitive eating?
I think there's several aspects. One will be brain science, neuroscience. Now, you know, we have exponential growth in the knowledge, in that the body of knowledge we have. And that will keep fueling our theories and, you know, the biomarkers we identified and so on. Another one is microbiome, you know, all these, you know, bacteria species that are living in our body in a synergistic way or, you know, harmonious way. A harmonious way that hopefully will help if when we have better understanding of what is what, it will help us to have a holistic view of you know, learning about ourselves in an intuitive way.
It's an exciting time to be in this field.
Yes, and the DNA, of course.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
Always important.
Well, Sherry Zhang, it was a delight to see you again. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Sherry Zhang is a nutrition and genetics researcher and the founder and CEO of Milwaukee-based Genopalette. There's more on intuitive eating at WUWM.com, and our interview with her first aired in January. Well, you are listening to us right now at the end of February. This is day two of our winter membership drive. Mitch Teich and I are in the studio to ask you to become one of the 11 new or renewing members that we need to get this hour.
And we can absolutely do it. I know we have 11 people out there listening. Many of you are already members, so thank you for that. But if you haven't yet renewed your membership or you have never become a member in WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is the time to do it. Because when you donate $10 or more per month or a lump sum of $120 or more per month, you'll automatically receive a WUWM tote bag, perfect for hauling around the food that you intuitively know that you want to eat.
Yes. For me, I would probably need two tote bags because I intuitively want to eat way more than I should. But this tote bag is great for outdoor events, farmers markets, traveling. It is a classic boat tote with an open main compartment and an open front compartment.
You can use it even if you are a landlubber, though.
Yes, absolutely. You do not have to be a water person for this. But you do have to be a member to get it. And you have to do it today because this is only available today. The phone number is 414-227-3210. You can also make a contribution at WUWM.com. Be one of those 11 new or renewing members, and thank you.
Your contribution goes directly to support interviews like the one you just heard about intuitive eating and the one you'll hear after a short break. An award-winning children's book author aims for a much older audience with a new collection of short stories. We'll meet Kelly Barnhill when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. Thank you.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. You would be forgiven if you expected that Kelly Barnhill's latest collection of stories is aimed at children. Barnhill is a previous winner of the Newbery Medal given to children's book authors, and the collection called Dreadful Young Ladies features a delicate dragonfly on its cover.
But very quickly, you'd be disavowed of that idea once you start reading the often dark and challenging themes contained in the short fiction. Barnhill, who lives in Minnesota, will talk about the book tomorrow evening at Boswell Book Company. She joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers ahead of her trip to Milwaukee and talked about her audience.
When we talk about work for children and work for teens and work for adults, I mean, what we're really talking about is not so much content, but view, right? A middle grade child is in the process of writing the world around them. They're literally building the world, and they are filling in the gaps. They're coloring in the spaces, and they're putting flesh on the bone. And so the view of a middle grade book is fundamentally outward, and which is why they're so interested in how the parts of the world work, and also like these big concepts like justice and love and courage and whatever. With teenagers, their view is inward. So most YA literature deals with these sort of fundamental identity questions. The choices that you can't undo, the things that make us who we are. I used to be a person who had never done X, and now I have done X, and now I am that person forever. And of course, that isn't true, but it sure as heck feels true when you're a teenager. With adults, the view is primarily backwards. We are asking ourselves, how the heck did I get here? And so nostalgia plays a much bigger role in adult fiction, as well as analysis, because analysis is fundamentally backward, too. So it's more asking why things are the way that they are, as well as how did we get here? And so you see more, and of course, with adult fiction, you get a lot more adult concerns, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and whatever. But also issues of things like trust and family and loss and all of these things that we are much closer to facing in our adult years than we are when we are children. So there's definitely stuff that. I wouldn't say it's like inappropriate for children, although there certainly are things that are. But I think it just wouldn't be relevant to children because the view is wrong. The view is backward and not forward.
As the view changes, as the perspective changes, what else changes about how you're writing the story, how you're crafting these narratives?
Good question. I mean, you know, so many of these stories, you know, were written in tandem with the work for children. I think the oldest story in the collection was published in, I think, 2007, and the most recent one was just 2 years ago. And I think, in terms of process, I don't put a lot of expectations on anything that I'm writing. I allow it to be whatever it is that it wants to be. And so being attentive to the work itself and being attentive to kind of the myriad of concerns that present themselves in the work itself as you're trying to come up with not only the world and the sort of central questions and the essential conflicts for these particular characters, as well as the necessary consequences of each character's actions, as well as the sound of the piece. I spend a lot of time thinking about the sound of each particular piece, and everything that I do, I read out loud again and again and again, kind of truing the aural sensibilities. And so I think I don't really ask myself about audience really at all until the very end when I hand it to somebody else and say, okay, which direction is this looking?
It's interesting that you mention reading it out. I was talking to a colleague recently about a piece that she's working on that's written, which isn't mm-hmm. always so typical for radio folk. And I was saying,
Right. Really,
you know, I have difficulty writing for the eye instead of writing for the ear. I only write for the ear. What is it like trying to, you know, they're two very different things. How do you balance that?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to balance, I think. I mean, first of all, we should mention that the eye is really forgiving, and the ear is not. It is really easy to, because when we're reading quietly, our brains have this tendency to add all kinds of things in there. And you'll notice this actually when kids are reading, because we're more likely to be, you know, reading along while a child is reading out loud, that they will flip words around because their brain has decided that word sounds better there, or they will add like little turns of phrases. They'll do all kinds of stuff like that, and that's because the eye allows for all kinds of malleability, whereas the ear is very, very specific. We will miss problems in the text by reading, but that we will never, ever miss when we're listening to it. And so I think for me, one of the things that sort of built me as a children's author was being a teacher and reading out loud to my students. I would read chapter books, you know, every other day. We would do another chapter in whatever book we were reading, and it was totally separate from curriculum and everything else. Because I wanted them to have that experience of being read to, and being in that place of like having the story in my body and having the story in my mouth and having it in my ear really altered the way that I wrote. And so I think that really all of my work is designed to be allowed. Now, there's still all kinds of visual tricks that you play with the piece as it appears on the page. You want to create visual space. You want to create a place in which your reader takes a breath. And so that, I think, is where the two become very, very linked when you think in terms of form and how the words lay on the page, you know?
Yeah, I'm speaking with Kelly Barnhill right now. She's the author of Dreadful Young Ladies and Other Stories. And Kelly, while Dreadful Young Ladies and Other Stories, certainly the subject matter isn't really for children or teens. It is fantastical in an almost childlike way. In some ways, the descriptions and the imagery that these stories evoke, it's reminiscent of Roald Dahl, for me at least. Is that intentional in a way?
Well, for sure. And, of course, Roald Dahl, it should be noted, also wrote short stories for grown-ups as well.
Yes.
And his short stories are awesome. And there is that same sort of quality in both his work for children and his work for adults. And for him, it in some ways is a little bit of his cynicism as well as his delight in the ridiculous. For me, I think what links my work for adults and my work for children is my own innate sense of wonder. And my own constant modus operandi is to be always looking for the strange and the normal and the normal and the strange. I have this tendency to think in hyperbole, and I have this tendency to see things kind of in an inside out sort of a way. And so I think that those same tendencies in thinking and those same tendencies in imagination show up in both my work for children and my work for adults. That same type of fantasticism and fabulism and sense of wonder.
Well, and with that in mind, when you're reading these stories, it's hard to know what's real and what's maybe imagined. But is there a difference between the two?
No, I don't think so, because no matter what, you're talking about human experience, you know? I mean, no matter what, when we're talking about human experience, most of the way that we interact with the world is imaginary anyway, right? The world that we see is in some ways, you know, our own brains making sense of visual information, and it isn't exactly the way that we see it. Like, the world is not as we perceive at all. Similarly, one of the cool things that we have learned with all the stuff with brain research and whatever is that as far as our brains are concerned, there's not really any difference between imagination and memory. It's the same structures that process it. It's the same structures that analyze it and make use of it, and which is why we, as writers of fiction, we use the all kinds of sort of the brain's ability to draw from memory and draw from old imagined happenings and instances in their lives and in their own imaginations to be able to create something new, to be able to create, to get, we expect that our readers have the tools to build the scene in their head, right? And all of that is a function of memory. But what that means is that a lot of what we remember is super wrong, made up, you know? And we all have that experience, you know, when we gather together at mealtimes at holidays. And the conversation will go to, like, some kind of event in the family. And every single person around around the table has a wildly different version of events and a wildly different take on what had happened. And part of that is that the way that we sort of construct memory, we use our imaginations to fill in the gap. And that's why we have false memories, right? It's changing how we understand the veracity of our own memory and experience. But the thing is that I don't think that that means that it's incorrect. I think that it actually just means that while the facts that we remember may not be true, the experience feeds us in a totally different way. And so I think that just like the brain has a hard time telling the difference between what is imagined and what is real and just uses context to be able to, like, kind of guesstimate, I think that when we're writing literature that veers into the fantastic, that we use that same sense of sense memory and realism and as well as that kind of sense of vertigo, you know, when we're not exactly sure where the ground is, you know, and I think that we do that so that it creates this sort of warbled mirror back onto the world that we live in, that we can see that our own sense of reality can often be skewed, and so we need to just learn how to trust bigger things, trust in our relationships, trust in our sense of, you know, love and justice and courage and these other sort of big ideas.
So in some ways, we're reading the world with our eyes instead of hearing it.
Yeah, and we're reading the world with with all of our senses, actually. I mean, we're constantly making sense of a world that doesn't always make sense, and which is very taxing on our brains. But I think that that's I think that's the attraction of literature, that that liminal space between the known and the unknown that pushes on the boundaries, because sometimes we need to be in a place where the bones of the world seem a little loose, and where the skin of reality can get pushed a little bit.
Kelly Barnhill, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciated the conversation.
Minnesota writer Kelly Barnhill's latest book is a collection of short stories called Dreadful Young Ladies. She spoke with Joy Powers, and you can hear her talk more about the book tomorrow evening at Boswell Book Company. Book interviews are a central part of what we do on Lake Effect. The number of authors that we have introduced you to over the, you know, 12-plus years that this show has been in existence, it's really a kind of a staggering number. And we can do that with, we are able to do that with the support of contributing members like you, who are taking part in our winter member drive by calling 414-227-3210 or visiting us at wuwm.com/give. Bonnie North and I are in the studio today to talk about why it is so important to be a supporting member of the station.
Well, it's important because exactly that. You are supporting all of the content that you hear, whether it's your favorite author that you get to hear a little more about why the book turned out the way it did, or maybe it's a musician that you've always wanted to hear kind of the backstory about why they wrote that song. Perhaps it's policy information. We have a lot of policymakers and people who are analyzing local and state policy on the show. Whatever you're interested in, it's pretty much guaranteed that you're going to hear it on Lake Effect at some point or another. And really, it wouldn't be possible without your financial support. So we're here to ask 11 new or renewing members. You don't have to be a brand new member. You can be somebody who's already on board and it's time to renew. If you are already on board, thank you so much. If you're not, it is a perfect time to show your support. 414-227-3210 or wuwm.com/give.
One more short break and then our Fit for You segment explores core strength. That's when we return with more of Lake Effect on listener-supported WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM Now. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Trainers will tell you that summer bodies are made in the winter. But for most of us, wintertime is a time about carbs. However, this month's Fit for You covers your core, what muscles your core actually consists of, and why it's the most important part to work on.
Many exercise novices might dismiss their core power and strength because, let's face it, doing hundreds of crunches does not seem all that appealing. But Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski met with personal and group fitness trainer Sonia Wren at a local gym to explore how versatile core exercises can be and how they help you get better in your other workouts. Wren started by explaining her definition of core strength and what it could achieve for your whole body.
Having the ability to have your spine appropriately connect with your lower body. So for me, from a functional perspective, it's if you're someone who falls and you have a strong core, you're more likely to not become injured. Or if you become injured, you're more likely to not become seriously injured. So I consider the core to be more or less the brain of the body. It kind of tells the body what to do. And then I kind of consider the glutes to be the engine of the body. So whatever you can do to strengthen your core muscles, whether that's core stabilization exercises, whether that's Pilates, sit-ups. But I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that your core is just like your abs, you know, that six-pack. So let's make sure we definitively talk about that. So it's all of your muscles from your chest to your knees and front to back. So I really focus in on strengthening all those muscles. The glutes, like I said, are the engine, but we have the obliques, we have your rectus abdominis, we have your diaphragm. Those are all the things. Obviously, you don't go to the gym and strengthen your diaphragm, but you strengthen those stabilizing muscles within that.
Now, when did core strengthening specifically become a part of the fitness regimen? I imagine, you know, since the first Olympics, athletes who are running, they are naturally getting some core strength due to how they're performing with other sports. But when did the advent of, okay, we're going to get on the ground, we're going to do crunches, we're going to specifically focus on our abdominals here, you know, when did that become a part of the workout regimen and a new standard for people to attain?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure exactly when it became popular for us lay people to talk about it. But I definitely would say maybe about 10 years ago was when I really started to notice going to the gym and them having a core class. And I think it's just because fitness professionals realize that pretty much the core is the whole focus of the body. It's the center purpose of your body. So the stronger your core muscles are, the more likely you're going to be able to run faster, to run longer, to be able to jump higher. So I think within the last 10 years is when people started to realize, hey, we need to really emphasize these core muscles, take note of them, do whatever we can to strengthen them, because they pretty much are everything to strength.
So, in your opinion, is there a difference between core strength and core stability?
Definitely. Core stability is basically the muscles that stabilize the core. So, when I think of core stability, I think of exercises like planks. For me, that's where I would start with a novice person, someone who's just getting started. I would start them off with planks. I feel like core stabilization, solid core stabilization, is created from those exercises. But if you have core strength, there's many different layers of core strength. You can do core strength as far as power is concerned. You can do plyometrics. You can do sit-ups, that type of thing. But for me, stabilization is you're holding a pose, and you're creating strength from holding that pose, and core strength is like more of a movement.
Many people might think of core strength and working on our core so that we can hold a position in a certain way, but really, do you find that it's about how well you can work against forces that are going on your body, like the ability to quickly turn, the ability to catch yourself if you're going to fall, things like that?
Oh, definitely. I feel that the spine is what keeps your whole body in alignment. So any exercises that you're going to do that will focus in on proper alignment is going to strengthen your spine. So I'm going to go back to the whole Joseph Pilates thing. So I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with Joseph Pilates, but he is the inventor of Pilates. And more importantly, he created the reformer. The reformer is a machine that really focuses in on core strengthening and flexibility. I think what people fail to realize is that in order to be strong, you have to be flexible. And in order to be flexible, you have to be strong. So what I love about Joseph Pilates and everything that he's done is he has really found a way to not only focus in on core strength, but also flexibility and the stabilization of the spine through exercises. To speak to what you said about an example of strength is that, you know, if something is working against your natural movement, if you have a strong core, your core muscles are going to be able to absorb that more effectively versus somebody who does not have a strong core.
So many people think of sit-ups or planks, as you mentioned, as the main way to work your core, but it's actually much more versatile than just those stationary exercises. So what's your favorite exercise for the core, or what kind of movement do you like for core work?
Mm-hmm. Well, I believe in the whole muscle confusion thing. So I like to do many different types of exercises. I love core stabilization exercises, like a plank, and I love to vary those. I like to do side plank variations. I have one of my favorite exercises that I created. It's called a smiling plank. So you just get into that plank position. You know, you stack your body. When I say that, I mean your wrists are over your shoulders. There's one line between your shoulders, hips, and knees. And you just take your toes and your feet and you walk them around into a smile. And you do that without changing the direction of your shoulders. And so you do that for as long as you can. And I happen to love that exercise because you could actually use that exercise with a very novice person who's just getting into the gym because it's low impact. And then you can do that with an athlete. You would just increase your time, obviously. So I love planks. I also love to use the Swiss ball. Okay, or the physio ball, because I feel like there's so many different things that you can do with that Swiss ball. Again, you can go back to planks. You can go back to core stabilization exercises. You can do like a bird dog stretch over a physio ball. I also love power moves. Okay, I love to get that heart rate up, cardiovascular endurance. So I love to do things like burpees, skaters, you know, single leg holds, things like that, where you're jumping up into a lunge and then coming back down and holding. All of those things, depending on your fitness level, is what's really going to help you to strengthen, quote unquote, those core muscles.
With beginners and novices, you mentioned planks are a great way to start that. And many people are intimidated if they go into a class or something and say, all right, we're doing core work. They'll look down at their stomach and not see that six pack. And they'll say, I don't have one. And it's like, no, you have one. Their muscles are there. But many people think, oh, it's end game if I don't already have a good basis to build off of. So what would you say to the people who are not necessarily timid, but nervous to take that extra step to realize that just because my stomach doesn't look the way I want it to doesn't mean that core isn't important? What would you say to encourage people to really think twice about concentrating on your core versus going to other cardiovascular exercises first?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that your core is probably the most important part of your body. Like I said previously, it is the brain of your body. So the more you can strengthen those core muscles, your six-pack, you know, your rectus abdominis, your obliques, your lower back, the more effective you are going to be in your exercises. I would say a gym is probably a great place to start, but I know that a lot of people feel very intimidated by a gym environment. So with that being said, go online. I think there are so many great ways to get into excellent shape in the privacy of your own home. But I don't think that that's the end all be all. I do think that ultimately you're going to need to change your game. You're going to need to get into the gym or get into a fitness class or go to a studio just to get that extra push and just to get that oversight from a true fitness professional. But for me, if you're novice or you just don't feel comfortable with starting in the gym, go online. I love to go on YouTube. And even though I'm a fitness professional, I get great ideas. And I think one of the biggest things that I want to tell your listeners is that start small, but think big. From the perspective of get the flexibility component in there with your core, get the strength component in there with your core, whatever you visualize as strength, whether that's weights or just, you know, whole body weight exercises in there, and get some cardio in there with your core. All those things, and you'll have a well-balanced body.
Well, Sonia, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Audrey.
Sonia Wren is a local certified personal and group trainer in Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski for this month's Fit for You segment. You can see photos of her suggested core exercises and explore past Fit for You segments at WUWM.com. Well, I don't know about you, Mitch, but I'm feeling very motivated to get out there and, you know, get those core muscles engaged. Maybe the best way to do that, though, is reaching behind me and getting into my pocketbook.
I was also thinking about doing some curls with a telephone receiver.
That's a good one.
Especially when you have finished dialing 414-227-3210. Or I suppose you could also do curls with your cell phone or your other mobile device. But before you do that, go to WUWM.com/give and play a role in our winter member drive. We just have a couple more listeners to go to reach our goal this hour of 11 new or renewing members. We can do it with your support. Just a few seconds left during this hour of Lake Effect. Call us now, 414-227-3210, or visit us at WUWM.com/give.
And today only, when you donate $120 at one time or $10 or more a month, you will automatically be entered into receiving a WUWM tote bag. It is great for outdoor events, farmers markets, and traveling. Great to bring your lunch, too, but your healthy lunch, because we want to show off that core strength that you are developing.
So take a minute right now. It takes maybe 2 or 3 minutes, but really the effects linger on. Just like a good workout, the effects linger on over the course of a year. And we're grateful for your support. That is all for Wednesday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Do be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's 11 o'clock and fresh air comes your way next.